Kane, Grant, Salvo, McMurphy, and Pollard left the ancient fortress by the same way they had entered it, cutting across the courtyard to where they had left Carthew. He was groggy from the drugs, but the pain of his injury was under control. Led by Grant, he was able to walk out of the dark ruins. As the team entered the canyon, Kane automatically checked the chron inside the wrist of his left gauntlet. Over 3 hours had elapsed since they left the Ville. As far as he knew, Salvo hadn't transmitted a status report back to the division, so if the mission had been strictly by the book, a backup bird squadron should be arriving at that very moment. Kane wasn't surprised to see only 3 choppers still squatting on their skids. A backup was nowhere in sight, either overhead or on the ground. The team climbed back into their respective deathbirds, and Grant powered up the engine. Slowly, the craft lifted off, rising vertically until it topped the uppermost rim of the ramparts of Mesa Verde Canyon. Grant's practiced hand rotated it gracefully and then sent it winging through the night. This time, Salvo's deathbird took the point of the Delta formation. Kane looked down at the hell zone, gleaming a dull gray white in the moonlight. It was like looking upon Earth's bare bones, scoured and bleached by nearly 2 centuries of chem storms and lingering radioactivity. On the border of the zone, soil, humus, and desiccated vegetation still clung obstinately to an imitation of life. People, more than likely dregs, still toiled and tilled down there, while the others, only 100 miles away, enjoyed the cake distributed to them by the Ville and the benevolent Baron Cobalt. Things had been different in antiquity, Kane knew. He couldn't be sure how different, or exactly in what way. The history he had been taught mostly covered events following the Nuke Cost, and before that, before Skydark, it was dim and inexact. It was said in the texts that people had taken a savage joy in raping and ravaging the world, deaf to the entreaties of more enlightened minds. The population had been staggering in number, billions, supposedly. Then came the Nuke Cost, which had fried 80% of them, and the subsequent horrors of geological catastrophes, fallout, and a horrific retribution for the sins of humanity. The world had suffered a dark age, though in actual chronological terms, the age had lasted only 115-plus years. Then the program of unification had been put into practice. With the cooperation of the 9 most powerful barons, the program had reached a success point in a little less than a decade. Unity through action had been the rallying cry. Part of the program had been education. People were taught that to be alive, to be a human, wasn't a special privilege, since humanity had brought about an apocalypse and its near extinction. The hierarchy of barons was dedicated to preventing another such holocaust. Their role as guides and protectors for humankind revolved around the same theme. People must never again be allowed to choose their own destinies, since invariably those choices led to disaster. Kane didn't understand why he should want things that were dead and buried. The pre-dark world had festered with hate and suspicion and pollution and war. It had taken the barons to clean it up the only way it could be cleaned up, by stamping out any deviation from the standard, forbidding all technology except to the very few elite who defined and maintained obedience to that standard. Like himself, Kane thought. Within an hour, the black sky mellowed to a pale indigo at the horizon. The comforting lights of Cobaltville beckoned, and he couldn't help but be glad of his return. He desperately wanted to shuck off his armor and wash away the bitter stink of the Hell Zone. The deathbirds soared steadily over the irrigated greenness of cultivated fields and over the silvery windings of the Kanab River, a tributary of the Colorado. Kane looked down at the city spread below. Cobaltville was built on the bluffs overlooking the river. Towers and walls perched on the hills, looking like a gargantuan battleship. The stone walls rose 50 feet high, and at each intersecting corner protruded a Vulcan Phalanx gun tower. Powerful spotlights washed the immediate area outside the walls, leaving nothing hidden from the glare. The bluffs surrounding the walls were kept cleared of vegetation, except grass, a precaution against a surprise attack. One of the official reasons for fortifying the Villes was a century-old fear of a foreign invasion from other nuke-scarred nations. It had never happened, and Kane had always wondered how the barons figured any country could mount a large enough army to establish anything other than a remote beachhead. Then there had been the threat of mutant clans unifying and sweeping across the country. Legend spoke of a charismatic leader who had united the Muti marauders to wage a holy war against the Norms. As far as Kane recollected, the war hadn't quite come off, but the memory of the threat was burned deep in the collective minds of the baronial hierarchies. It had burned so brightly that a major early aspect of the program of unification had been a campaign of genocide against Muti settlements in Vil territories. Inside the walls stretched the complex of spired enclaves. Each of the four towers was joined to the others by pedestrian bridges. Few of the windows in the tower showed any light, so there was little to indicate that the interconnecting network of stone columns, enclosed walkways, shops, and promenades was where nearly 4,000 people made their homes. In the enclaves, the people who worked for the Vil administrators enjoyed lavish apartments. Every comfort was built into them: plumbing, artificial lighting, refrigeration, and air conditioning. All the bounty of those favored by the Baron. Kane and a few other magistrates lived in the upper levels of the enclaves. Far below the enclaves, on a sub-level beneath the bluffs, light peeped up from dark streets of the Tartarus pits. Though it was very late, the pits were awake and seething. The narrow, twisting streets were crowded. Neon light flashed luridly, making blacker the shadows of the alleys and lanes. These sectors of the Vils were melting pots, where outlanders and slaggers lived. They swarmed with the cheap labor, and random movement between the enclaves and pits was tightly controlled. Only a magistrate on official business could enter the pits, and only a pit dweller with a legitimate work order could even approach the cellar of an enclave tower. However, Kane knew of at least one undetected route into the enclaves. The population of the pits was as strictly and even more ruthlessly controlled than the traffic. The barons had decreed that the Vils could support no more than 5,000 residents, and the number of pit dwellers could not exceed 1,000. Kane retained vivid memories of making pit sweeps and seeking out unauthorized outlanders. They included infants and even pregnant women. He did not relish those memories. Seen from above, the enclave towers formed a latticework of intersected circles, all connected to the center of the circle, from which rose the administrative monolith. The massive round column of white rockcrete jutted 300 feet into the sky. Light poured out of the slit-shaped windows on each level. Every level of the tower was designed to fulfill a specific capacity. E, or Epsilon level, was a general construction and manufacturing facility. D, or Delta level, was devoted to the preservation, preparation, and distribution of food. And C, or Kappa level, held the magistrate division. On Beta level was the historical archives, a combination of library, museum, and computer center. The level was stocked with almost 500,000 books, discovered and restored over the past 90 years. It also held an incredibly varied array of pre-dark artifacts. The work of the administrators was conducted on the highest level, Alpha level. Up there, in the top spire, far above even the enclaves, the Baron reigned alone, unapproachable and invisible. Kane had no clear idea what went on in A-level. The secrecy surrounding the Baron and the administrator's activities was deliberate and jealously guarded. Almost everybody in all the other divisions was kept in ignorance about the actual number and identities of the administrators. Fraternization between division personnel was strongly discouraged, presumably so no one would know anything that the administrators didn't want them to know. Midway on the side of the monolith, a flat, massive slab began extending like a monstrous, squared-off tongue. A circle of fluorescent light blinked rhythmically on the exact center of the slab. Grant angled the Deathbird down toward the landing pad, projecting from the level housing the Magistrate Division and its dozen subsections. Mechs scurried out of a cavernous opening on the side of the tower, securing the landing skids with cables attached to eye bolts sunk in the rockcrete. Medics rushed out and put Carthew on a wheeled stretcher, quickly rolling him inside. Kane and the team walked inside the monolith as giant gears and pulleys withdrew the landing pad. The Magistrate Division level was huge, containing classrooms, a weapons range, a vast armory, wardrooms, a cafeteria, a gymnasium, and a computerized intel center. It also held dormitories for recruits. Kane thought of his first morning at the division, when he was 12, and how he awakened on his bunk before dawn, cold, frightened, yet strangely eager for the day to begin. His 4 years of training had conditioned all childish fears and frailties from his mind and body. He remembered his final examination when he was 16, a day that marked his last day as a recruit and his first day as a badge-carrying magistrate. There was no such thing as failure of the examination. Those who survived it were the ones who didn't fail. Following the standard procedure after a foray into a hell zone, the team filed into a cubicle and removed their armor, handing the pieces to Tex that stood by for that purpose. Then, naked, each man waited his turn to enter the medisterile unit. Kane was the first to step inside the man-sized bullet-shaped chamber. Dozens of nozzles studded the tiled walls. When the door sealed behind him, high-pressure jets of warm disinfectant sprayed from the nozzles. The streams of fluid covered him from the top of his head to the soles of his feet. Kane worked the decontamination spray into his body to help penetration into every pore. The monthly immunity boosters all Legalville residents received weren't powerful enough to protect them from long exposure to hellzone levels of ambient radiation. Outside, in another cubicle, the techs were washing down his armor and ordnance with a similar decontaminant. He wasn't worried about one of them rifling through the compartments of his belt and finding the compact disc. They were pit dwellers, outlanders hoping for citizenship, and such a brazen act of disrespect would never occur to them. Warm air whipped around him and dried him completely. When he stepped through the far door of the chamber, into the ready room, his decontaminated armor and weapons were neatly stacked in his locker. Kane removed his duty uniform from where it hung and quickly slipped into the pearl-gray, high-collared bodysuit. He was tugging on his black, calf-high boots when Grant emerged from the medisterile unit.
Just heard. We can go off duty.
What do you mean? When's the debrief?
Shrugging his broad shoulders, Grant opened his locker and took out his own bodysuit.
Don't know, but it's not scheduled for tonight.
Why not?
How do I know? I'm just glad to go home.
Kane frowned. A debrief was SOP, especially after a deep penetration. He opened his mouth to mention it, but Pollard and McMurphy entered the ready room. Pollard was about Kane's age, McMurphy a little older. A black and purple bruise showed on the side of Pollard's right knee. Of all the men on the team, Grant was the oldest, a year away from a mandatory administrative transfer.
How's Carthew, Pollard?
Blind in one eye and can't see shit out the other.
The medics have him in surgery already. They can maybe save one of his eyes.
Kane grimaced in sympathy, but it wasn't as if the man had a family to support. Magistrates were allowed to marry and produce legitimate offspring only when they had an administrative post. For Carthew, even if he made a full recovery, such a transfer was at least 2 decades away. Becoming an administrator in the division wasn't a promotion exactly, nor was it completely based on age, though that was certainly a factor. The quality of service was the most important consideration. However, in the past 14 years of his active duty, Kane had seen a number of men with less experience and younger than he assume administrative posts. He wasn't annoyed by it, only vaguely curious. While the other men were busy dressing themselves, Kane quickly removed the compact disc from his belt and slipped it inside the pocket of his black ankle-length Kevlar weave overcoat. He shouldered into it, a little uncomfortable as always with its weight. The right sleeve was just a bit larger than the left to accommodate the sin-eater and holster he strapped to his forearm. After attaching his red badge to the coat's lapel, tugging the fingerless black glove over his right hand and slipping on the prerequisite dark glasses, he was ready to go off duty, though he didn't look like it. Even without the body armor and visored helmet, the magistrate mystique, foreboding and not a little sinister, had to be maintained, especially during his downtime. It wasn't all for show. The lenses of the glasses allowed him to see clearly in deep shadow, and the overcoat could turn anything from a knife to a .38 caliber round. The glove allowed a secure grip on the butt of the sin-eater.
Kane, report to my office.
My, don't he sound happy. I expect he wants to discuss that comment you made back in the zone.
What comment?
You remember, when you made a passing reference to his illegitimate lineage.
Oh, that.
No matter what he says, keep your fuse unsparked.
Kane walked past the rows of lockers, through a swing set of double doors, and into the communal day room. People hustled around him, most of them wearing the gray bodysuits. There were no women, not even filling support positions. He stayed only long enough to swallow a cup of straight sub. He desperately wished something stronger was available. Out in the corridor, he strode quickly toward the office suites. Taking disciplinary action against a villain forcer was a rare occurrence, since a man had to be supremely disciplined to be awarded a duty badge. Generally, the worst penalty for an infraction was to be assigned a guard station at the bottom level of the Enclave Tower in the pits. The most severe punishment, outside of termination, was to be stripped of citizenship, barred from all the vills, reclassified as an outlander. It had never happened in Kane's lifetime, and even before he was born, barely a handful of citizens were reclassified. It only required a few examples to make everyone else tread the ace on the line. Salvo's office was shaped like a small oval, with one end chopped off. He sat behind a desk, likewise an oval. At his back was a broad window framing the moonlit towers of the Enclaves.
You may sit, Kane.
He gestured to a chair on the opposite side of his desk.
Take off the shades. Yes, your behavior tonight is compatible with your bloodline.
What do you mean, sir?
Your father and grandfather occasionally pushed the envelope of discipline. Your grandfather in particular, but then he was a first-generation magistrate, and all the parameters of duty had yet to be established.
He was highly decorated. His service record is still held up as an inspiration to recruits, sir.
Salvo stopped leafing through the stack of papers, lifted his head, and stared unblinkingly. Kane met that stare. Salvo was 6 or 7 years older than himself. He had a flat, sallow face that was almost round, and his eyes were a deep dark brown, like swirling pools of muddy water. His gray-threaded hair was cut very short, and in places the scalp showed through. He wasn't very big, but he was big enough.
I don't want to discuss your family tree or its accomplishments. You and I had problems in the zone tonight. Why?
Permission to speak freely?
This is Liberty Hall.
It was a triple stoop mission. No preliminary rec, no adequate intel. The team was undermanned, underprepared. It should not have gone down the way it did. We were lucky to have gotten out with only one casualty.
I see. And you hold me responsible.
As commander, it doesn't matter if I hold you responsible or not. You are responsible.
Indeed. Why do you think I kept the team to a bare minimum, chose the men I chose, and didn't hold a debrief? Simply a whim on my part?
I'm sure you have your reasons.
Are you interested in hearing them?
I am, sir.
The welfare of the Vills is entrusted to our care. We have dedicated our lives to checking the spread of poison. Poison like slaggers, joltwalkers, roamers. By and large, we've been successful. Now, though, the poison is growing in virulence and spreading from the outlands, tainting the Vill territories. Do you understand me?
You're talking about another rebellion?
It isn't a rebellion, not precisely. It's something bigger and nastier than that. The Baron himself doesn't know exactly what's going on. You know what the Outland settlements are like, especially the ones near Hell Zones. No enforcer or Vill spy can last a minute in them. So all we get are the rumors.
Rumors of what?
Fantastic stuff about a self-styled warlord holding ancient pre-dark tech secrets. Military materiel, supposedly. Nerve gas, maybe. Possibly even a nuke warhead. Or even more advanced than that. You see anything like that in Wreath's place?
Beyond the computers, the gun turret, and the electrical generator, no. Damn hard stuff to get, but nothing unusual or pre-dark about it. Of course, there's still no explanation how Wreath got the stuff, or how he seemed to know you, sir.
And you wanted that explanation, so you disobeyed my order to serve an on-site termination warrant. You questioned him, I assume. What did he tell you?
Very little. He refused to speak unless you were present. Of course, when you were present, you didn't allow him to speak.
True enough. I was following orders, as you should have done. Don't worry. I'm not contemplating disciplinary action against you.
May I ask why?
Tonight's circumstances were unique, but I chose you, Grant, Pollard, McMurphy, and young Carthew, because all of you have special qualities. You think fast, you move fast, and though there's a downside to it, you can also be independent. And all of you can be trusted to keep secrets.
What kind of secrets?
That's still classified. But if the information will ease your mind, I'll tell you this much. Tonight's penetration was part of an ongoing covert op. So covert it won't even show up on the reports. Only the Baron and his immediate staff will know about it.
Kane's mind wheeled and extrapolated. It was possible Baron Cobalt had authorized a black penetration, and it was also possible that Milton Reith had been part of some type of sting, a link to the Warlord rumors. All of it was possible, Kane conceded, but damn little of it was very likely for a variety of reasons. The chain of command protocols was always observed and respected in the division. By invoking the Baron, Salvo didn't have to justify why he broke the chain, and that seemed very convenient.
I still find these rumors a little hard to swallow. The Outlanders are too divided, too concerned with survival to ever make a concerted effort to overthrow the Vils.
Think of it this way, Kane. A long time ago, fearful of atomic war, the major governments played a stoop game called the Balance of Terror. It should have been obvious, even to the most idiotic of them, that sooner or later the balance would be tipped in the wrong direction. It finally happened, and we had a planet that came very close to being destroyed. What we have now is a complete about-face from the pre-dark lunacy. There can never be another Balance of Terror with two or more factions holding blasters to each other's heads, while everybody else sits on their thumbs wondering who'll be the first to pull the trigger. We've got to make goddamn sure only one faction has a blaster. We can't afford to ignore any hint that somebody else is trying to achieve another balance, even if it turns out to be only another wild outland rumor. Do you understand?
Yes, sir.
Excellent. I hope I've quelled the doubts in your mind. You may go. Kane.
Sir?
Salvo held a short stack of slip-sleeved computer disks between his hands. Idly, he fanned them out on the desktop like a pack of cards.
You didn't happen to pick up anything at Reith's place, did you?
Like what?
Like anything.
Kane slipped his dark glasses on over his eyes.
No. Why do you ask?
Just routine. I'll be asking the same question of every member of the team.
I see. Good night, sir.
As he walked past the armory, Salvo's stomach muscles clenched tightly. They always did when he approached the huge storage facility that occupied nearly a quarter of sea level. A pair of gray-clad men, eyes masked by dark glasses, stood guard before the recessed massive vanadium alloy sector. They held full-auto commando arms carbines across their chests. They didn't acknowledge Salvo's approach or passing with so much as a nod, even though technically he was their superior officer. The protocol of armory sentries was very simple. Chill anyone who tried to gain entrance, regardless of rank or social standing. Only a direct voice authorization from the Baron was good for admittance. The knowledge that even he was a legitimate target when around the arsenal always turned the pomp of Salvo's high rank to tinsel. It seemed disrespectful. Oh, he understood the reasons for the strict regulations. The walls of the huge chamber were lined with rack after rack of assorted weaponry. Everything from rifles and shotguns to pistols, mortars, and rocket launchers. Crates of ammunition were stacked up to the ceiling. Armored assault vehicles were also parked there, the Hussar Hotspurs and the AMAX, not to mention disassembled Deathbirds. Almost all of it was original issue, dating from right before Skydark. The planners of the old COG, or Continuity of Government, programs had prudently recognized that unlike food, medicine, and clothing, technology, particularly weapons, if kept sheltered, could endure the test of time and last generation after generation. Arms and equipment of every sort had been stockpiled in underground locations all over the United States. Unfortunately, the COG planners hadn't foreseen the nuke cost would be such a colossal overkill that the very people the stockpiles had been intended for mostly perished. Some survivors of the nuking and their descendants carved out lucrative careers looting and trading the contents of the stockpiles. Hordes of exceptionally well-armed people once rampaged across the length and breadth of the Deathlands. When the program of unification was instituted during the Council of Front Royal, one of the fundamental agreements was that the people must be disarmed and the remaining stockpiles secured. Of course, to institute this action, the barons and their security forces not only had to be better armed than the Deathland hordes, but they also had to know the locations of the stockpiles. The barons were provided with both of these requisites, and far more. The early years of the program had been very violent and bloody. When Salvo was young, he had met a few doddering oldsters who claimed to have been in the thick of things, sweeping across the continent, driving the anarchist scum and so-called Baron Blasters into the sea. There had been one group of Baron Blasters who had escaped the deadly sweeps, and in some parts of the Outlands they were still revered as folk heroes, the subject of ballads and tall tales. The band, led by the legendary Cawdor, was long gone, but their exploits, if believed, were clearly a lesson for posterity. Salvo shook his head to clear it of mental meanderings. Now that he was well past the armory, he relaxed a bit. He didn't want to appear tense or distracted during his audience with Baron Cobalt. A dozen yards beyond the guards at the sector, he turned to the right, down a tight, windowless passage. The passage dead-ended at a service access way, a locked door that supposedly led down to a generator room. Salvo inserted a key into the lock. Inside the door was an elevator shaft, just large enough to accommodate two men. He slipped onto the pancake-shaped disc and pulled the door shut behind him. Automatic lock solenoids snapped into place, and the disc on which he stood shot upward. Up. Way up. Far above all the other levels. He strode quickly across the ramp and down into the Baron suite. All the strings of power in the Ville extended down from this level. The foyer was magnificent, as was every room he'd ever seen in the suite. Glittering light cast from many crystal chandeliers flooded every corner of the entrance hall. He couldn't help but smile wryly at the lavish evidence of power, especially when he occasionally received memos that the intel section was fast using up its allotted monthly quota of electricity. At the far end of the foyer, flanking huge ivory and gold inlaid double doors, were two members of the elite baronial guard. Their polished black boots had walked no other surface than these equally polished floors. Their white uniform jackets and red trousers had never been exposed to the elements of the Outlands, let alone a hell zone. They gazed at him impassively in his drab gray bodysuit, and inwardly he cursed them and Baron Cobalt for contriving such a situation to instill a sense of uncertainty and inferiority. The guards opened the doors, and as Salvo walked between them, he saw their faces twist, for the merest fraction of an instant, into sardonic smiles of superiority. Salvo ignored them. He had long ago filed their likenesses in the termination pending section of his memory. If there should ever come a day when they found themselves within reach of his power, he would take great satisfaction in stripping them of their immaculate uniforms and dropping them naked from a deathbird into a hell zone. Before him, he saw nothing but a deep, almost primal dark. Not black, because he could still make out dim shapes, but a dark that seemed soul deep, extending into an infinite void. Salvo kept walking forward, knowing where he was going. The Baron's level was the only one in the monolith without windows, and though he burned a great deal of electricity in the foyer, he always kept his living quarters a few shades lighter than obsidian. One room led to another through a wide, low arch. The succession of rooms went on, and Salvo always started to feel as though the rooms would never end, with yet one more lying beyond, then another, all illuminated by the gray glow from an unseen light source. But in the fifth and final room, Salvo stopped. Eight men stood in a formal semicircle in the center of the enormous Persian carpet that covered the floor. Several of the group were administrative members of the Magistrate Division. One was a high-ranking archivist, and four were of Baron Cobalt's personal staff. Though he knew all of their names, he didn't know them personally. Salvo managed to keep the surprise he felt from showing on his face. At most, he had expected two, maybe three, of the Baron's staff to be present, He had no idea that the entire membership of the Trust had been summoned. Suddenly, the reason for his audience with the Baron was much more important than simply delivering a report about the Mesa Verde penetration. None of the men spoke to him, nor did he speak to them. A meeting of the Trust was neither the time nor the place for social niceties. Every Ville had its own version of the Trust. The organization, if it could be called that, was the only face-to-face contact allowed with the Barons, and the Barons were the only contacts permitted by the Archon Directorate. The mission of the Trust revolved around a single theme: the presence of the Directorate must not be revealed to humanity. If their presence became known, if the technological marvels they had designed became accessible, if the Directorate's history filtered down to the people, then potentially the Directorate would be forced to visit another Holocaust upon the face of the Earth, simply as a measure of self-preservation. And that capability was there, Salvo had been told upon his induction into the Trust. To prevent another apocalypse, maintaining the secrecy of the Directorate and their work was a sacred trust. Unfortunately, no secret as complex and as wide-ranging as this one could be completely hidden. Rumors abounded about the Directorate and the totality concept even before the nuke cost. During the century and a half following the Skydark, some of the secrets were discovered. Humanity, what was left of it, was too scattered for even the Directorate to control. The near annihilation of the race hadn't diminished the race's inborn sense of curiosity, the drive to search in strange places for strange things. Many of those strange places were penetrated, the strange things uncovered, but humankind was too concerned with day-to-day survival to reason out the whys and the wherefores behind them. It required only a generation to reduce the knowledge of strange places and things to mere rumors, and another generation to fanciful legends. Salvo recalled that some 30 years before, a junior archivist in Ragnarville had found an old computer disk purporting to contain the journal of one Mildred Wyeth, a scientist. According to the journal, she had been in suspended animation during the nuking, and she had survived the Skydark and the long nuclear winter to be revived a century later. Sometime during her wanderings, she recorded her thoughts and observations regarding the post-nuke cost world. Although she had no inkling of the true nature of the redoubts or even the presence of the Directorate, a number of her extrapolations came too close to the truth. The Trust suspected the Wyeth Codex had been downloaded, copied, and disseminated like a virus through the historical divisions of the entire Ville network. There was no solid proof of this, of course, only anxieties that gave rise to the fear that an elite group of historians, insurgents, labeled preservationists by the Intel section, might know far more than the Trust, or even the Barons themselves. All the men turned as one to face a patch of murk. In the gloom, a door slowly opened. Behind a filmy gauze curtain, a golden light, suffused in pastel hues, slanted down from above. As the gong rang out, the shaft of muted golden light became a glare. Right before the glare faded to its previous soft hue, a dark figure appeared within it. The Baron had arrived. Salvo, in 23 years as a magistrate and his 5 years as a member of the Trust, had never gotten a clear, unobstructed view of Baron Cobalt. With his eyes still recovering from the sudden glare, and with the figure drifting, always in nervous motion, pacing back and forth behind the golden filter, he received the same impression as always, a gaunt man under 6 feet tall, head bowed as if in intense concentration, one hand under the chin, the other behind his back. He appeared to be wearing a flesh-colored bodysuit with a short cape drifting from the shoulders. The Baron's face was in dark shadow, but Salvo was able to glimpse a long, narrow visage and a round, hairless skull that seemed just a bit too large. He had no idea of the color or shape of the Baron's eyes.
Milton Reith.
Salvo didn't respond for a moment, and inwardly he cursed his hesitation as he stepped forward.
The termination warrant was served by my own hand. I collected all the evidence of the arrangement.
The slim figure of the Baron paced into the murk, a flitting shadow. Then it returned to be silhouetted by the golden light.
Regrettable. His merchandise was excellent in the beginning. Why he thought he could continue supplying such execrable substandard substitutes remains a puzzle.
Abrams, the magistrate administrator, took a slight step forward.
Greed. He was offered a unique opportunity. We set him up to take full advantage of it. Yet he desired more, and he desired it more rapidly.
Yes, he found it easier to attract dregs with his promises of smuggling them into the Ville. Healthy outlanders were skeptical of him, and the dregs had nothing to lose.
Greed. It's a kind of sickness, a compulsion. What of the men you chose to implement the termination? Did they see or hear anything that would arouse suspicion?
No, Baron. Wreath was too afraid to reveal anything to them. He evidently thought a mistake had been made in administration, and it could be rectified if he spoke with me.
He was correct in a way, wasn't he?
Lakesh, the wizened senior archivist, eyed Salvo with suspicion.
What about that loose blaster of yours whom you took along?
I have no such men under my command.
Come now, Salvo. Lakesh is being annoyingly oblique, but you know to whom he refers.
Cain saw nothing of importance. If he did, it was beyond his understanding. I spoke with him privately only a few minutes ago, and he accepted the cover story. If he is curious, I kept it in check.
Superficially, perhaps. Curiosity runs very strong in the Cain line. We all remember his grandfather and father, possibly two of the best magistrates in any division in any ville.
Gwende, a small-statured staff member, nodded at the mention of the senior Canes.
Yes, indeed. And they suffered the same fate as that fabled cat, at least in the case of your predecessor, Salvo.
The Dulsa operation is a very critical one, as we know. The need for raw materials seems to increase exponentially the closer the program comes to fruition. Therefore, Salvo, it's been decided by the Trust, after a consultation with the Directorate, that you are instructed to take charge of the accruing, processing, and transportation of the merchandise to Dulsa.
Thank you, Lord Baron. I will faithfully...
This is a particularly delicate operation, even in these late stages. The new cost prevented it from achieving completion, and now finally it is within sight. It is a matter requiring careful planning, and therefore absolutely no unforeseen variables to contend with. You must use your position in the Magistrate Division to carry out the edicts, and that means you will need help. A confidant, a pawn. With all the men under your command, surely there are some who would be of service to you in this undertaking.
Salvo was silent a moment, then smiled coldly.
Only one, Lord Baron.
Yes?
Cain.
Huh. Ridiculous.
What? Are you mad? His father?
The Division is Cain's only father. He has no idea of what actually happened to the man. He probably thinks he's still up here, pushing paper and filling out water requisition reports. No, Cain is as hard and as bright as a blade. He has no use for slaggers or outlanders. With the proper inducement, I'm sure he would find my offer a very unique opportunity.
And so do you, for cruel irony.
That has nothing to do with it. Cain is like his father only in his devotion to serving the Ville.
Yes, we believe the same of his father, to our sorrow.
The proposal has merit on a number of points. If Cain refuses your offer, Salvo, an accident on duty can easily be arranged. Or like his father, he can be appointed to an administrative position and never be seen again. Yes, Salvo, I approve.
Thank you. You will find your confidence well placed.
The golden light flickered, dimmed, and Baron Cobalt stepped back beneath the arch. The audience was over as quickly as it had begun. The pudgy man named Horan wasted no time whirling on Salvo.
This is a dangerous game you're playing.
Consider then that the advantage far outweighs the risk.
How can you possibly trust Cain? His father, his grandfather?
He's a magistrate first, a Cain second.
Salvo turned and left the other members of the Trust standing on the Persian carpet. Abrams caught up with him before he passed through the final arch.
A word, if you will.
Abrams' carriage was ramrod straight, despite his deeply seamed face, the iron gray in his hair, and square-cut beard. Salvo nodded to him respectfully. Abrams was one of the old guard of the division, entering it at the very end of the first generation. Despite the fact he had served as an administrator longer than he had as a magistrate, Salvo had to admit that Abrams' performance in both positions was outstanding.
Your plan seems ill-conceived, almost perverse.
Why do you think so?
Because Cain has options. He is not alone. He is not isolated. He has a friend and therefore an emotional center, a grounding in an identity.
You mean Grant.
Yes. Though fraternization between magistrates is discouraged, you have allowed those two to forge a bond.
Grant is due for an administrative transfer. That will break the bond.
It will weaken it, not shatter it. The bond must be broken as dramatically and traumatically as possible, so Kane will seek a substitute to fill the void, as was done to me.
Salvo suddenly understood. Abrams's lover had been chilled by a self-styled pit boss decades ago. He'd become cynical and morose, and therefore an excellent candidate for the trust. Salvo also understood Abrams had accepted the likelihood that the murder had been ordered by the Baron, not the pit boss.
Yes, Administrator, as was done to you.
He turned and left the chambers. As he entered the brilliantly lit hall, he paused long enough to stare contemplatively at the two guards. They met his gaze impassively.
Soon.
His thoughts swarmed with speculations. He would make his new responsibility a spectacular success. And then neither the Baron nor the Directorate could deny him anything, even a whim. Nothing else mattered. Instant termination would be the immediate fate of anyone who opposed or even postponed that success, including, even if the circumstances didn't warrant it, the third magistrate to bear the loathsome name of Kane. Kane didn't go home. He hung out in the day room, taking a corner table away from the door, blocked from the glances of passers-by in the corridor. The table was also out of range of the vid spy eye attached to the ceiling. He sipped at a cup of sub and read over the daily intel report transmitted along the Vill network. Intel level. Copies all mag divs. Ragnarville, Minnesota. After several incursions in the territory, a band of roamers was apprehended and terminated. Sympathizers within Vill also terminated. Mandeville, Kansas. Measures taken to degrade fighting ability among hostile Lakota group include introduction of nerve toxins into hunting grounds. Snakefishville, California. Report of sticky clan settlement on Western Island investigated. No foundation for report. The reports from the other five bills comprising the network were similar. Even by reading between the lines, there wasn't even the vaguest hint of a rebellion brewing anywhere, much less the appearance of a charismatic warlord. The territories controlled by the Vills were vast. Cobaltville itself had absorbed several Colorado baronies, including Vistaville and Hightower. The other Vill territories were arranged similarly. So if anything as big and nasty as Salvo had described was brewing, some crumb of intel should appear in the reports. Though it was heresy even to think of it, Kane was certain Salvo was lying. The barbs about his father and grandfather had been aimed to prick his pride, make him question his doubts. Kane held his two namesakes in high regard, and he felt that he, the third Kane to serve as a magistrate, had to measure up to a level of duty established decades before. The use of first names in the division had been taboo for three generations. The original drafters of the program of unification had believed that only surnames engendered a sense of obligation to the duties of their ancestors' office, ensuring that subsequent generations never lost touch with their hereditary roles as enforcers. Last names became badges of social distinction, almost titles. If nothing else, Kane thought a little sourly, it kept every man toeing the line so he wouldn't tarnish the honor of his antecedents. Kane had never met his grandfather. He had been chilled 15 years before Kane was born in the retaking of the pits from insurgents who believed Vill authority was completely arbitrary. That had been a bloodbath. Many magistrates had been literally torn limb from limb by the rioting pit dwellers. As for his father, Kane had seen him only rarely after he had joined the division. Though they were never close, his relationship with his father had turned stiff and coldly formal, as if the man were disappointed in him, or afraid of him. His father had virtually disappeared from his life once he assumed the mandatory administrator's post. For all Kane knew, he could have died 3 years ago, shortly after the last time he had spoken to him. He lingered for an hour in the day room, then went out into the broad, brightly lighted main corridor. As he headed toward the elevator tube that would deposit him at his enclave, he passed Salvo's office. The door was open, but the desk was vacant. Kane kept walking, then turned sharply into the intel section. 2 steps inside, he paused and looked around. His arrival was unnoticed, except by the spy eye rotating slowly on the ceiling. The room was spacious, with vaulted walls. In the cool semi-darkness, more than a dozen people were sitting before banks of computers with flashing readouts and indicators. Vid monitor screens displayed incomprehensible images, probably from the alleys of the pits. Kane's gaze shifted to the left, and he spotted the man he was looking for. He waited until the vid spy eye lens was no longer focused on the door. Then he strode over to Morales and clapped him on the shoulder.
How are you?
Morales looked up from his deck of computers, hard drives, and monitor screens and forced a smile, trying to wipe away the look of boredom on his swarthy face.
Fine. Working late, are you?
Just a little. I wonder if you'd like to do a little favor for me.
Morales suddenly sat up straighter in his chair. No matter how it was worded, a request from a magistrate was always a command. Kane knew that and how to exploit it. Turning his back to the vid camera on the ceiling, he fished the compact disc from his pocket and handed it to Morales.
Put this through a read program, please.
Morales eyed the disc warily. Normally, computer time demands came through the duty officer, but the likelihood was that the tech wasn't inclined to point this out. He inserted the disc into the input port. The triangle and line symbol flashed onto the screen.
Disc is locked. Access denied. Encryption key required. Do you have the key?
No. Just run it through the sign, why don't you?
Nodding, Morales popped out the disc and plucked a small metal device from a hook beneath his desk. The NEMA sign, or sign as commonly called, was a lock decryptor shaped like an elongated circle divided down the center by a thread-thin slit. He placed the edge of the disc into the slit and thumbed a stud on the instrument's surface. Morales removed the disc from the decryption device and pushed the disc back into the hard drive. The monitor screen lit up with the red triangle and the same message again.
This shouldn't happen. The sign was designed to perform only one function, to sidestep security lockouts and make digital memory accessible and available. The encryption lock should have been overridden.
Morales tried again, but the image and words on the screen remained unchanged.
This is something you don't see every day. Whoever wrote the program knew how to safeguard it against the sign.
Who would have that knowledge?
Nobody I know, that's for sure. Want my best guess? Whoever wrote the program either helped to engineer the sign or had access to the specs.
He slid out the disk and handed it back to Kane.
The thing's useless unless you stumble onto the encryption key. I suggest you take it up to archives. Somebody there might have an idea of how to unlock it.
Thanks. By the way...
Yeah?
This never happened. You never saw me. We never had this conversation.
I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know anything about encryption codes. I'm just a key tapper.
I know. That's why I came to you.
The shaft doors opened upon Kane's enclave living level. Just outside the shaft was a wrought iron gate, tall and heavy, with metal hinges that looked like tarnished brass. Kane placed his right hand flat on the small iridescent panel on the front of the gate, where the keyhole should have been. Within the panel, the sensor grid read his handprint. The gate swung open noiselessly. The promenade was virtually deserted at this hour. The broad pedestrian avenue was lined with evergreen saplings, giving the recycled air a pleasant fragrance. The trees were illuminated by lamps hung from the lower branches. Kane passed rock-crete stoops leading up to single-dwelling apartments. Each facade looked the same, with one window facing out on the promenade. In the half-dozen lit windows he glanced into, he saw the same furnishings, the same color schemes. The four-room apartments were essentially interchangeable. Kane went up the stoop to his flat and opened the door. It was unlocked. None of the doors on any enclave level had locks. It was a carryover from the Program of Unification, when the Council of Front Royal had decided that privacy bred conspiracy. The Council had further decreed that since everyone had the same possessions as everyone else, there was no need to steal, especially among the elite. The desire for privacy was viewed not only as gauche, but as an expression of deviant thinking. Kane was pretty sure, though, that the pit residents had locks on their doors. Once inside, Kane went to his cabinet and found his bottle of vintage wine. Grant, who had found it during a pit sweep the year before, had given it to him as a gift. He carried it over to his sagging couch and flopped down, looking out through the three tall windows on the far side at the lights glittering on the surface of the administrative monolith. From his pocket, he took out the compact disc and held it in his palm. Morales had suggested he take it to the historical division, but since this wasn't an official line of inquiry, he would be risking having his request channeled to Salvo for confirmation. Kane considered swallowing a sedative capsule along with the wine so he could reverse his anxiety and get some sleep, but the tranquilizers often made him feel as if he were walking underwater, and such sluggishness of mind and reflexes was anathema to a magistrate. Glancing around at his few paltry personal possessions, he realized that he had absolutely nothing anyone would want, except maybe the bottle of wine. It wasn't much, but it was all he was ever likely to have. Most of his property had been inherited from his grandfather and father. His apartment was more or less the Kane ancestral home. A couple of lamps, a chair, a table, a sofa, and the futon in the bedroom. A few antique books wrapped in plastic, a couple of ancient muzzle loaders confiscated from traders nearly 30 years ago, and a pics of himself standing between his father and mother. He looked at the image of the cocky, eager kid he used to be. He was smiling in the picture. His father and mother weren't. His dad had the same dark hair and high-planed features, but he looked brooding and unhappy. His mother looked the same. Kane hadn't seen either of his parents in years. His mother had vanished from his life right after he entered the division. Her disappearance wasn't unusual. Though matrimony and child-producing were considered the supreme social responsibility by the barons, it was also considered only a temporary arrangement. Children were a necessity for the continuation of society, but only those passing stringent tests were allowed to bear them. Genetics, moral values, and social standing were the most important criteria. Generally, a man and a woman were bound together for a length of time stipulated in a contract. Once the child entered a training regimen of one of the Ville divisions, the parents were required to separate, particularly in the case of male children recruited by the magistrates. So his mother had removed herself. Her duties discharged, the rest of her life must have been one long anticlimax. Considering the roles of women, he thought of a woman he had seen several months before on the promenade. He had learned she was a high-ranking archivist, and she lived on this enclave level. He couldn't be sure, but he thought her name was Baptist or something.
Yeah, Baptist.
Bridget Baptiste stepped out of the tiny shower stall and used a towel to dry her mounds of red-gold hair. Rather than don the bodysuit with the small rainbow-striped insignia of the historical division on its breast, she walked naked into her private cubicle adjoining the bedroom. The cubicle had once been a closet, but she had converted it into a crowded, miniature version of her work area in the division. There was just enough space in the small box of a room for her desk, desktop display, and a chair. The computer was a cast-off DDC model, one that had been remanufactured several times. The older the DDCs became, the less able they were to sustain their workloads. Bridget had picked this one up out of a trash hatch and spent weeks repairing it. Technically, what she'd done was illegal, but archivists were allowed a certain leeway in the pursuit of their professions. Besides, she was fairly certain the machine had been planted deliberately by a preservationist for her to find and salvage. She sat down at the machine, turned it on, and put on her badge of office, a pair of wire-framed, rectangular-lensed spectacles. Unlike many archivists, the eyeglasses were not of historical importance to her, but were a necessity. Years of inputting pre-dark data and documents, reading screens, and staring at columns of tiny type had resulted in a minor vision problem. The barons frowned on contact lenses as expressions of human vanity, and therefore considered them superfluous. Bridget closed her eyes and regulated her breathing, focusing her mind on the documents she had seen that day. Almost everyone who worked in one of the divisions kept secrets, whether they were infractions of the law, unrealized ambitions, or deviant sexual predilections. Brigid Baptiste's secret was the ability to produce eidetic images. She could, after viewing an object or scanning a document, retain exceptionally vivid and detailed visual memories. When she was growing up, she feared she was a psi-mutey, but she later learned that the ability was relatively common among children and usually disappeared by adolescence. It was supposedly very rare among adults. Brigid often suspected her eidetic memory was the primary reason she had been covertly contacted by the preservationists, but there was no way they could have known of her ability, except through information provided by her mother. Brigid hadn't seen her in 13 years, yet she found comforting the possibility that her mother was somehow associated with the preservationists. Now 27, Brigid had trained for 10 years to be an archivist, and for the past 6 had worked as one. Archivists were primarily data entry techs, albeit ones with high security clearances. Mid-grade senior archivists like herself were editors. A vast amount of pre-dark historical information had survived the nuke cost, particularly documents stored in underground vaults. Tons of it, in fact. Everything from novels to encyclopedias to magazines printed on coated stock that survived just about anything. Much more data was digitized and stored on computer diskettes. These were usually government documents. Even though she was a fairly senior archivist, she wasn't among the highest. Those in the upper echelons, holding X clearances, were responsible for viewing, editing, or suppressing the most sensitive material. Still, she had glimpsed enough to know there were bits and bytes of information that were still classified, even all this time after the nuking. Her primary duty wasn't to record pre-dark history, but to revise, rewrite, and oftentimes completely disguise it. The political causes leading to the nuke cost were well known. They were major parts of the dogma, the doctrine, the articles of faith, and they had to be accurately recorded for posterity. Scheming Russians had detonated a nuclear warhead in the basement of their embassy in Washington, D.C., even while they negotiated for peace. American retaliation had been swift and total. The world came very close to transforming into a smoldering, lifeless cinder. People were responsible. Russians, Americans, Asians. Humanity as a whole. Brigid had believed that, of course. For many years, she had never questioned it. Humankind had been judged guilty, and the sentence carried out forthwith. As she rose up the ranks, promoted mainly through attrition, she was allowed greater access to secret records. Though these were heavily edited, she came across references to something called the totality concept, to devices called gateways, to a place called the Anthill Complex, and to projects bearing the code names of Kronos and Whisper. These hinted at phenomena termed probability wave dysfunctions and alternate event horizons. She wasn't foolish or disturbed enough to voice her growing skepticism of the accepted dogma. She realized something more was there. But archivists were always watched, probably more than anyone else working in the other divisions. She had worked hard at perfecting a poker face. She wondered if some of the material handed to her was a test to gauge her reaction. Because of that suspicion, she had gained a reputation for cool, calm, unflappable, and immutable. The only time that composure nearly cracked was one morning a year before, at the beginning of her shift. She had inserted a computer disk into her machine and opened it up. She had selected the disk at random, and so the message flashing onto the monitor screen had stunned her into momentary immobility. In that numbed moment, she read, "Greetings, fellow scholar. We are the preservationists. You have distinguished yourself as a seeker and collector of knowledge. Only those deemed most worthy of preserving the hidden history of humanity are selected to join us. We will contact you again very soon." Then the message faded from the screen as if it had a programmed time limit. Brigid never mentioned the message. She was terrified by it, yet enthralled at the same time. Weeks passed before she was contacted a second time, and she supposed the gap between communiques had been deliberate, a way of finding out if she would report the incident. She also suspected a trap, something devised by the magistrates. Only someone in her own division could have planted the disc. God only knew how long it had been on her desk before she had chosen to open it up. The second message was just as brief, promising to contact her again in the near future. In the weeks that followed, more messages appeared on her screen. She slowly understood that the preservationists were archivists like herself, scattered throughout the Vills. They were devoted to preserving past knowledge, to piecing together the unrevised history of not only the pre-Dark, but also the post-Holocaust world. Whoever the preservationists were, they had anticipated her initial skepticism and apprehension. To show their good faith, she found an unfamiliar disc in her work area one morning. When she opened it, the message said simply, "Read only in private." Shortly thereafter, she had found, retrieved, and repaired the cast-off DDC. Though her curiosity was almost an agony, she kept it in control until the computer was operational. Then she slid in the disc and read the data it contained. On the disc was the journal of a woman called Mildred Winona Wyeth. A medical doctor, a specialist in cryogenics, she had entered a hospital in late 2000 for minor surgery. An idiosyncratic reaction to the anesthetic left her in a coma, with her vital signs sinking fast. To save her life, the pre-Dark Whitecoats had her cryonically frozen. She was revived over a century later by Ryan Cawder, and she joined his band of warrior survivalists. It was startling to read that Cawder was indeed a real person and not a folk hero. Though the journal contained recollections of adventures and wanderings, it dealt in the main with Dr. Wyeth's observations, speculations, and theories about the environmental conditions of post-Nuke-Cost America. Her journal also delved into the history of one Dr. Theophilus Algernon Tanner, who'd been a test subject for a project called Operation Kronos. Bridget hadn't known how much of the Wyeth Codex to believe, or who her mysterious contact might be, but the Wyeth Codex began her secret association with the preservationists. Her assignment was to memorize any documents at variance with Vill doctrine, put them in cogent form, and use the trash hatch where she had found the DDC as a dead drop. Bridget's machine at the division was voice-activated, and this manual keyboard seemed slow and clumsy. She entered the data she had glimpsed on a Department of Defense document, bearing the date of April 30, 1994. Since she had merely glanced at it, no one would suspect her memory retained almost every word and punctuation mark. She did not input the document verbatim, since the preservationists encouraged extrapolation. Her archivist's training demanded that she proofread her work.
Possible origin of Magistrate Division. Source, DOD document, dated 4-30-94. The concept of a one-world government was known in pre-Dark vernacular as the New World Order. The globalist view was opposed by many American citizens as a conspiracy to remove legal and civil rights granted to them by the Constitution. Re, file number 01405. The conspiracy theories were given a degree of plausibility by the so-called black helicopter phenomenon, circa 1970 through 1997. Black and silent, these helicopters were unmarked and therefore unidentifiable. At first reported in remote areas, the aircraft seemed to be engaged in clandestine missions. They were repeatedly seen in conjunction with what was known as unidentified flying objects, refile number 65391. Contemporaneous with these sightings of both black helicopters and UFOs was the mystery of mutilated farm animals and occasionally human beings. Self-professed UFO investigators speculated that the helicopters were part of a covert military force working in tandem with extraterrestrials. The extraterrestrials allegedly required animal tissue and blood for sustenance or for the genetic process of creating alien-human hybrids. Re-file number 89003. Though the DOD document does not directly address this possibility, it does refer to the Archon Directive as the project overseeing the animal mutilations. The document also states quite clearly that one aspect of the mutilations dealt with the secret testing of biowarfare agents, including viruses specifically targeting certain ethnic groups as part of the Human Genome Project. The document also makes reference to urban warfare training programs, wherein house-to-house searches for illegal firearms were conducted in major cities during the early 1990s. Men in black armor, disgorged from black helicopters, conducted these searches. In 1992, Alaska hosted an event referred to as Police 2000, with participating military and police personnel from America, Russia, and Canada all merging to form a transnational police organization designed to protect the coming global village. Obviously, by the time of the nuke cost, the creation of an international police force was well underway. The DOD document mentions PPD 25, a presidential directive signed in 1994 that opened the door to direct intervention in domestic affairs by officers of this international police agency. The document defines quite frankly the broad powers granted to this supranational authority to enforce the edicts of the New World Order. Therefore, it is reasonable to assume that the formation of what evolved into the Magistrate Division was already underway. The document makes this statement: their authority will be based on internal disruption of current societal norms.
Bridget raised her arms above her head, arching her back to work out the kinks in her shoulder muscles. She tried to keep her mind empty, visualizing nothing but the rest of the document. The bedroom door swung open, and her head swiveled toward it so quickly she felt a twinge of tendon pain. Immediately, almost instinctively, she swept her hand across the keyboard, hitting the escape button, clearing the screen of its data. She stared at a dark-haired, clean-shaven man in a long black overcoat. Though she couldn't see it, she almost felt the bore of the sin-eater trained on her naked body. Nothing had been true. It had been a trap after all. The magistrates had found her.